Welcome, everyone, to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. In this episode, you're listening to myself, Justin, and Jeremy from Hardblock. Today, we'll be discussing our personal journeys with regards to setting up, investing in, and managing our self-managed superannuation funds. But before we start, a quick word from our sponsor. The Australian Bitcoin Podcast is brought to you by hardblock.com.au. Hardblock is Australia's oldest Bitcoin-only exchange. They have no added fees and are optimized for dollar-cost averaging. Sign up to Hardblock today using the discount link in the description below to receive free auto-send batch Bitcoin withdrawals for 6 months. All right, Jeremy, how's it going?
Yeah, pretty good, Justin. How are you?
Can't complain. Good to get together and talk a bit about how to protect for our futures while the world falls apart.
Exactly right. Yeah, I'm pretty much there now with my super. So, yeah, we can good time to talk through it and what the challenges were and why I did it. And
definitely.
It definitely feels very much worthwhile now that I've done it.
Likewise, and I'm probably ahead of you by about a year in that regard in terms of I set mine up last year and I've just gone through the first audit.
Yeah.
So it's good to sort of like, you know, get those two different stages of the process because that tends to be what most people kind of ask questions about is like, how do I set it up? What happens when it comes time to audit? Which almost then leads to the question of like, what are you meant to do in between those 2 points?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I guess a good point to start conceptually would be, why did we decide to set up a self-managed superannuation fund?
Yeah. So I think for me, I actually think there's three levels. There's the kind of the default super you get when you get a job and no one looks at that and they just tick a box and it's someone else manages for them.
Mine sat there for about 15 years, I think, until I was like, all right, what's in this thing? What should I do with this? Is this working well for me?
Exactly. And that those people that invest your money, they don't have skin in the game.
Mm.
So they get paid a salary and they probably get paid a bonus if they do well. But if they do badly, they don't give you money back, right? So there's no risk for them. There's only reward. And so you don't want them investing your money. So a level between that and self-managed is you can actually buy shares in a lot of super companies. So I had ING for a while and I was actually buying my own shares for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So I was managing it in a way, but they just, like, you can't buy Bitcoin. They only let you buy about 300 shares in the stock market and only certain ETFs.
And it would be like amounts. Australian-only shares, not international. So if you like the international company.
Oh, it wasn't so much. I could have probably done that, but it was more like they said, gold is risky. It was the highest risk category. And I could only put 10% into each gold ETF, for example.
God.
Whereas like bonds were the least risky. And I could have put 100% into bonds, which you and I think is the opposite of how it should be.
That's right.
So they're kind of, there was a lot of controls on what I could and couldn't do. But the main thing for me was you can't buy Bitcoin in that type of investment. So self-managed just basically opens up every investment option. As long as you meet a whole heap of requirements around your paperwork, which we'll get into. But so that for me was the driver for me to do it was for Bitcoin. But there's some advantages that I guess I hadn't appreciated. So for starters, you can buy anything on the ASX. You're not limited to the top 300 companies.
Mm.
And you're not limited to saying, you can only get 10% in this. But another advantage that over time will be quite beneficial is I'm combining my wife's and mine into one super fund. And we pay one fixed fee.
That's right.
So no matter how much it grows to, I'm still paying that fixed fee for both of us. So at the moment, it's probably you kind of net out. But over time, that will actually be a benefit to us as well.
That's true. The point you made about how current super fund investment managers, I guess you would call, don't really have the right incentive because they don't have skin in the game. The way that I looked at it as well is that there are certain things that's probably much easier for them to invest in because of things like government regulations and kind of government priorities around things like maybe construction and property or bonds, which means that some of their decisions are just driven by what's the path of least resistance, what's easy, not what's best.
Yep.
And that doesn't make sense to me as a way to invest. The other thing is I don't know what you would call it in terms of an effect or a phenomenon, but the fact that they're all kind of benchmarked against each other means that if you take a pretty low risk approach and just do what everyone else is doing, you're never going to be benchmarked badly.
Yep.
You can either say we performed well and about as well as everyone else, or we performed badly, but actually you wouldn't have done that well going with someone else either because everyone performed badly. It's just the market.
Yep.
And to me, that's a cop out. It's kind of like saying, let's just do again what's easy and what everyone else is doing. That way you don't ever take a risk or stand out. But innovation happens when you actually get a little bit to the edge of that risk curve, I think.
Exactly right. Yeah, so they've got the career risk.
Yes.
You know, if they invest in government bonds, they go down and that's fine. They've got their career. But if they invest in Bitcoin, it goes down, they get fired.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and often they'll say, we beat the index. Yeah, but the index is down 20%, so I'm actually down 19%.
Right,
I want my super to go up.
Yeah.
And another big factor as well is a huge super fund like Australian Super, where I was before, they can't buy a company with a $20 million market cap because it's just they have too much money.
Gotcha.
So I literally can't go into a lot of the investments that are potentially got the highest reward potential
because
they would move the entire market. They would buy that entire company. So it's actually quite a difficult task to buy a lot of something, which, you know, if you're something like Australian Super, you have to buy government bonds and big global companies because you've got so much money to invest.
Whereas
as individuals, we're not going to move the market. We can buy anything.
Yeah, that's very true. I guess for me, conceptually, just bringing it back to like a first principles things, like I wanted Bitcoin. I think that was the detail that got me looking into self-managed superannuation funds. But the more I looked into it, and once I've done it, I've looked back and gone, well, that's given me more autonomy and flexibility about both the investments that I choose, but also in the zombie apocalypse scenario, so to speak, where institutions fail and fall over, you need to leave the country or you need to find yourself, you know, hold up somewhere. Zombie apocalypse probably won't happen. But if it does, I kind of want to be protected to some degree by having custody of my own assets.
Yep.
Probably being in Bitcoin helps me think this way in terms of like autonomy, flexibility, and self-custody. But a self-managed superannuation fund is the only thing I can see that lets me do that with my super, regardless of what I invested in, whether it is Bitcoin or whether it is other assets, basically.
Exactly right. Yeah, the self-custody is a pretty good, because it not just even for the zombie apocalypse, because you know that there's no fractional reserve. Like if you have it in your hands, you have 100% of that asset. Yeah. So like even if it's, you know, storing gold at a gold exchange, how do you know they have your gold there? Like they could be doing fractional reserve.
True. Especially when there is so much speculation about there being a lot of paper trading or assets, hard assets like gold, where if there is a run where people want to take self-custody of it, there is at least a potential that you're not going to get your gold before someone else.
Exactly.
What about moving on to, I guess, what the process was for setting up our SMSFs?
Yeah. So I'm not going to lie, it was a lot of work. I think the benefit definitely outweighs the cost because the work is only in 1 year and this is going to be for a few decades in
terms
of the return. So it definitely is worth the work, but it is a lot of work. So just keep that in mind. So I went with SMSF Warehouse, who we've done a podcast episode with. In fact, I went with them because of that podcast episode because they made it quite clear what you had to do. So the application form is on their website. So you fill out that form. You have to obviously have whoever's going to be in it agree to be in it, and you go kind of discuss the investment strategy, which I'll get to. But yeah, basically you fill out a form with them. They then sent me a heap of paperwork. So there's a ton of paperwork to get signed and witnessed. And this is kind of the theme of this whole process.
Yeah, lots of signing and paperwork.
It's lots of paperwork. Witnessing is surprisingly difficult to facilitate. You know, if you're in the office, it's actually not too hard. But so there's that. And then I just made some note because there's a lot of steps. So then they get you an ABN, which is pretty quick. But there's a lot of steps that are very slow. So the ATO have to take your review your fund and make sure it's compliant. And actually, both my wife and I got a call from the ATO. And it seemed to me like there must have been a lot of scams in the past where money had moved. And because this is what I do here at Hardblock, I call customers and try and tell if they're trying to be part of a scam or something. Yeah, I was very familiar with what the guy was doing. But yeah, so he called us, and then by the next day, once he was happy with our situation, he gave us all these warnings. Once the fund was compliant, I then had to roll over my super, like both of our supers, into this new fund, which again is another process. You have to do the right form through the right website portal and everything. Something to keep in mind, you do have to pay tax at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got any profits, you're going to be paying capital gains tax, which is lower in super than it is if it wasn't in super, but still you've got to keep that in mind. If you have a figure that you're seeing after tax, you may not get that same figure. Another thing to consider is that during this time, if you sold, it does take time to move the funds. So the funds will be sitting there in cash for some period of time. And you might miss a move, which was a bit stressful for me. In the end, it worked out in my favor, but that was pure luck, not any kind of skill.
There's nothing worse than knowing that you're about to have funds available and seeing the price come down, but then not having
access to them.
And also, no, it's going to be sometime in the next 2 days to 2 weeks.
Well, no, literally the time frame was 2 to 56 days.
I love it. Fiat time frame.
Yeah, exactly. So then, and the final kind of, well, there's a couple more steps. I then had to change the employer contributions.
Mm-hmm.
So my current, that old super fund is closed now. So then my pay, like the super in my pay, has to go to the new fund, which again is just providing some details. You set up this code that basically the people pay into, and that kind of validates the bank address. So you got to set up that code as well, which is not that hard. You pay $40.
Is that the ESA code?
That's the ESA code, yeah.
That's the new one that Zoe said. There's no benefit. It's just regulation,
which
I love to hear from an accountant and an auditor because that's very true.
It's $40 a year for I don't know really what, but that's the new system. And then you have to also set up a bank account for your super, and if you want to do trading, like share trading. So I went with Macquarie because that's what they kind of set up for me. It's easier. It's not the greatest interface, but I believe it is easier for SMSF in terms of their auditing and stuff. It's kind of designed for SMSF in terms of the audits. Their audits, the transactions you need to give them, I think, are easier to provide. So that's it. So that's kind of like just getting it set up. Then something, if you're not kind of familiar with it, all of a sudden you're in charge.
Mm.
So you then have to make the decisions of, okay, what am I going to invest in? When am I going to invest in? Which we'll come to. But yeah, that was my process. The whole thing in terms of getting, like starting off the process and getting money in my account took about a month.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually moving the money into where it needed to go, that takes a few more days because, you know, there's limits on how much you can do per day and so on.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and it didn't have Poly, which was super annoying, so I couldn't like instantly move it to Hardlock and get there because there was a really good price on it. I could see my money, I could see a price, and I didn't have Poly, so I had to wait like 3 days. But
I ended up getting a Commonwealth Bank CDIA, so a cash deposit investment or other, and they have Poly Pay that's accessible, luckily. Yep. But my process was very similar to yours. I went with my personal accountant because I asked the question and he seemed to know that it's a relatively simple process. He just gathered details for me. So like who's going to be in the fund, what are your tax file numbers, any ABNs, birth dates, addresses, etc. He prepared most of the documentation in terms of establishing the fund, assigning members or trustees into the fund, and then the investment strategy. Just asked like, what do you plan to invest in and roughly what kind of percentages? And he more or less prepared most of that documentation, sent it through to me to then sign and get witnessed and send back. And apart from that, it was similar steps to what you've just described, where I then had to contact my old superannuation fund, which was ING as well.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, they don't make the form accessible on the website to roll over. You have to contact them, get them to send it to you, you fill it out. You got to verify your identity with like a justice of the peace verification. And then you got to send it in snail mail. So the whole process takes about 2 weeks for them to get the form in the first place. Then it takes another 2 weeks for them to liquidate your funds, roll it over. So that was, to be honest, probably the longest process of like just the rollover process to me in terms of the waiting time.
I think the ESA code replaced that process
because it easier. Yeah. That was the clunkiest point, especially when I said you need to verify your identity. Again, it's like, well, it's all right, fair enough. I have to go through it. But and then snail mail, just like to top it off. After that, it was setting up self-managed super fund accounts. So like in the name of the fund and with the fund ABN. So it's quite distinctly separate from my personal finances. And that was a bank account, a CompSec share trading account, because those were free and online signups, which took me like 10 minutes each. So that's the reason I went with, the Evil Empire Combank. And then setting up Hardlock. So my Hardlock exchange account. Once everything was rolled over into my super, again, similar to you, it's then a point of then deciding what am I going to invest in, moving some of it into Hardlock through things like Polypay, so it's relatively quick. And CompSec, it was already accessible because that's linked in with my Combank CDIA for any like shares or gold or that kind of thing that I wanted to buy.
Yeah, I can definitely say the Commonwealth Bank one is much better than Macquarie, but I haven't been through the audit process. So maybe I'm hoping Macquarie will be easier.
I reckon it will. Yeah. So I guess for people to know what happens in between, you need to, maintain your fund, so to speak, which means maintain records.
Yeah.
And so if you're buying or selling anything, shares, Bitcoin, stocks, property, whatever it might be, you got to kind of keep those individual transactions, but also get the end of financial year transaction too. If you contribute into the fund, you also need to, what would the word be? It's kind of like you're alerting the ATO there's a form, just speak to your self-managed superannuation fund administrator. For me, it was my accountant just to say, look, I'm going to make a non-compulsory contribution. And he said, that's fine. We can just sort of sign something towards the end of the year that gives ATO the kind of heads up that they need, even if it's sort of retrospectively, and then we can count it as a contribution. The reason I said your fund will probably be easier come audit time is that there were a couple of statements that I didn't realize I needed to get that when it came time to the audit, I thought I'd provided all the details to my accountant. And he said, I need this statement and this statement. But, you've already got all those details from the individual statements throughout the year, but they also need that final statement to kind of as a way to reconcile, I guess. And of course, some auditors probably are very specific about which form that they need or which statement that they need. And even though they have all the individual statements, they want to see like the final one that summarizes everything. So there was a few like back and forth at the last minute. That wasn't a big issue. But I imagine if SMSF Warehouse is linked in with Macquarie, they probably don't even need that. They probably already got access to those.
That's
statements.
My understanding. And also, so for example, the way the fees are structured, you pay a monthly fee and that kind of covers everything except for the Bitcoin auditing, with charge you an extra fee annually.
Gotcha.
But yeah, you can just kind of set that up. So there's like a monthly fee coming out of your account, but you have to make sure obviously you've got enough cash to pay that. But yeah, I believe that will be easier. Yeah.
The other step is that every year you should review the fund strategy as well. And by review, you need to have like minutes of a meeting. You need to have some sort of documentation.
Usually.
I think one of the biggest criticisms of SMSFs is when they don't have that kind of information. And if you know, push comes to shove at some point, they'll be looking for that documentation. If it's not there, it almost begs the question of like, can you run a self-managed super fund if you're not documenting those things? So it needs to be like, oh, we sat down at this address at this time. Here's who was present. Here's the like the agenda items of the meeting. Here's what we discussed. Here's what we decided. And that should happen every year. And even if it's to say, our fund strategy is still appropriate for our circumstances, we're leaving it unchanged, there still needs to be
a record of that.
Yeah, that's right. You could probably get away with that not happening, but if anything happened bad with the fund and there was an audit, they would say, well, you haven't been doing your yearly reviews, so can you really manage this fund?
Yeah.
So you need to make sure you do that, especially if you do want to update it, of course, is to record why you've decided to update it.
Yeah, and what I like, and I should say as well, we don't have any kickbacks or anything with SMSF Warehouse. Mm. So even though I've chosen to go with them, we just have a backlink on their website.
Yeah.
But they basically have got all the legal templates. So they basically, if you need like to have a meeting with minutes, they provide you a template that you can kind of fill out and then sign at the end.
That makes sense.
That has made a lot of it, you know, so much easier.
That is something that I don't know if accountants and SMSF administrators want this to be transparent, but it kind of is once you go through the process, is that if there's any documentation that you haven't done throughout the year, when it comes time for the audit, I mean, your accountant's job, your SMSF administrator's job is to kind of make sure that everything does line up to audit, not doing anything dodgy, but they'll say, okay, so you did meet, you just didn't record it. That's cool. We'll type it up for you, send you the document, you can sign it now.
Yep.
And you might be signing something with a date far before the current date when you're signing it, but it's enough to kind of cover you in that audit process. So generally speaking, I think most accountants and SMSF administrators are aware what auditors need. So they will do that, not for you as such, but they'll kind of put the frame of the.
That's why I chose a specialist. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting when they said in the podcast, they don't do personal accounting. They just focus on SMSF. So they're specialists in that and they would know what paperwork needs to be done at what time. And
that's
one of the things that convinced me to choose them.
Was there any issues along the way in terms of your setup or maintenance so far?
Not major issue. I guess I felt like I had to be following up things quite a lot. Particularly, I think the rollover, probably the like for me as well, the more complex part was just rolling over the money. Because when I spoke to ING, if I spoke to two or three different people, I got different answers.
Yep.
So that like I was waiting a couple of days and they said, oh, no, you've got to go to MyGov and like click a button and then we can roll it over.
Mm.
But that's the first person I spoke to gave me a different answer. I didn't have to do that. So I lost a day waiting, which, you know, didn't work out too badly. But yeah, so I guess that was probably the least good advice. That would depend on where your super is.
Gotcha.
That part of the experience. I guess waiting for the ATO to call you, like if you didn't, and it's not so easy to call them back. So if you missed that call, that would probably be annoying.
True. I didn't have that step. They never called me up. Whether that's because they didn't have that ESA step where they get a bit more involved.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe you have some red flags, Jeremy. And
maybe.
We got to call this guy.
Maybe he works at Bitcoin Exchange. But I think I gather there's been a lot of fraud and this is the response to that fraud.
I'm just noticing a trend, at least with Bitcoiners and probably just the broader, you know, crypto space and alternating capitals, is that more people are setting up self-managed superannuation funds. So as that demand or that just volume increases, almost that begs there to be some sort of like regulatory oversight or a little bit more perhaps where they go, oh, okay, this is a trend. Let's start looking into like, is everyone doing this properly? Is there a scam that's happening that we're not aware of that we need to kind of be mindful of? Whereas maybe go back a year or two or three, I don't think it was such a big thing, self-managed superannuation funds.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about it. I know my father-in-law does it, but you know, he's come from the stockbroking industry. But I guess there's such large amounts of money involved.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a weird money that you don't feel like you really own, even though it is your money. It's like, oh, it's my super. It's different to my bank account. But there's an incentive for a scammer to put a fair bit of investment into someone if the payoff is, you know,
larger,
six
much
figures.
Larger. Yeah. That's right.
So I think, you know, you could kind of believe that that'd help you through the process and then all of a sudden, you know, buy the Bitcoin here and I'll help you do it. And
exactly.
All of a sudden it's gone. But yeah, so I think, look, it wasn't too bad. Yeah, you just had to be prepared that you know, every couple of days you're checking your emails and responding to things. And
yeah, my experience was similar to you. And I think the time frames, it took me probably between 4 to 6 weeks in total. And similar, it's just like a lot of waiting more than anything else.
Yep.
Like it takes a bit of time to get through the first tranche of paperwork, like the establishment, the appointing the trustees and the strategy itself. But then after that, I guess, the role of the paperwork too. But after that, it's kind of just waiting for people to give you details, and then you can start getting access to things.
Yeah. Now, honestly, the worst thing was just not being able to just buy the Bitcoin and lock in the price. That was, you know, just waiting and not being able to do anything.
That's it. I think my issues with the process were more so towards the audit side of things. Mm. So something for people to keep in mind is that usually documents related to self-managed super funds for annual reporting need to be submitted in May, the following year after the end of financial year.
Right.
So the end of financial year ends in July, but then it's not until the next May that you need to submit everything for that previous financial year. However, when it's the fund's first year, it needs to happen in February, not in May. So my accountant just does everything in May.
Yep.
And I followed up multiple times because I had a letter from the ATO saying, we haven't received anything from you yet and your deadline's coming up in February. So just letting you know, that's your deadline.
Yep.
So I followed up with him. Everything seemed under control. And I don't mean just a few follow-ups. There was about 8 different phone calls. And each time he would sort of reassure me that everything's under control. We've got all the documentation here. There's nothing amiss, basically. Unfortunately, by the time March rolled around, my fund was made non-compliant. So I wasn't able to put contributions into it.
Yep.
I had already made the investments that I wanted to, so I don't have to give any of that back or anything else. Yep. So it didn't really impact me drastically. But it was very frustrating to be dealing with, an accountant that says everything's under control, but then it's not. We ended up submitting everything in May, which was just their usual process. And then everything went back to being compliant. So I'm aware that that's happened to 2 other Bitcoiners that we went to the Bush Bash with their self-managed superannuation funds as well.
Right.
So this is not a rare thing to happen. Mm. Of course, when I was going through it, I'm thinking wow, great. This is going to make me a red flag for audit. I'm going to be compliant, but then they're going to come and audit me immediately afterwards. Or maybe I'm going to have to pay a fine or something like that. Again, my accountant was very good at reassuring me and saying, none of that's going to happen. This is very, very normal. This is totally fine. We will get to it. It will happen. And then it'll all be complying again. So all kind of what felt very dramatic at the time, now I look back and I'm like, that's not really a big of an issue. But for anyone who's going with just an accountant rather than a self-managed superannuation fund expert, I would say be mindful of that time frame, because that same thing might happen to you, because it's happened to about 3 of us so far. Okay. Yeah.
So kind of suggested probably best to go to a specialist.
I would say so.
It doesn't have to be the one, I went with. There's Green Frog and there's a couple others that we know
about.
Yeah, there's
eSuperFund, Red Jay Accounting.
Yeah.
And these are all kind of Bitcoin-friendly places that I mentioned as well.
Yeah.
I would say, I don't want to sort of say bad things about organizations, but New Brighton Capital, I hear a lot of bad things about.
Yeah.
Very, very high costs, lots of restrictions. They suggest going to places like BlockFi and Celsius and so forth, which obviously what's happening in the news with them now, that's obviously not the best risk management approach. So yeah, I would say just go with funds that aren't exorbitantly priced and give you more flexibility. Because if they're not giving you flexibility, it usually means they're not experts in the area. So they're kind of locking things down from a business policy perspective rather than a government or broader regulatory perspective.
Yep.
So yeah, go with an expert.
Yep, definitely.
The other, issues that people should be aware of is that along the way, you should become familiar with maybe more advanced wallet software. So the ones I'm thinking of are mainly Sparrow Wallet or Samurai Wallet. And the main point being is that when it comes time to audit the fund, you need to prove that you have ownership of the Bitcoin.
Yep.
Now, each auditor does this slightly differently, apparently. Some of them will just let you tell them what receiving address the Bitcoin went into, and they'll check on a Block Explorer and say, yep, that Bitcoin still seems to be there. I'll assume that you own it. It's sort of an honor system. My auditor actually wanted the public key belonging to that receiving address.
Right.
So you can't generate the public key from the receiving address, but you can generate the receiving address from the public key.
Mm-hmm.
The public key doesn't let them know any of my other receiving addresses, and it also doesn't let them spend that Bitcoin. So generally giving away the public key is not that drastic of a thing. However, you need to find a way to get the public key of that receiving address. And there's a few ways you can do it. Sparrow Wallet and Samurai Wallet just tell you what the public key is. It's very easy to find that information. Otherwise, you might need to use a wallet or a seed calculator, like Ian Coleman's BIP39 calculator or Bitcoin Q&A's seed calculator. But that would require you to enter in your seed words and passphrase into a website somewhere, which I wouldn't suggest doing. I would say probably best to do it on something like Sparrow Wallet or Samurai Wallet, because you can put in your XPub. You can kind of put in just some information, but not the actual private keys.
Yeah.
That might sound very confusing, and we're actually going to cover some of that stuff in another episode, so don't worry too much. I think the point is that you need to have some way of being able to provide a bit more detail than just your receiving addresses.
Yeah.
The great part about those two wallets is you can also sign messages with your private key without giving your private key away. I believe in future auditors are probably going to be asking for that, because that is the best verification that you still own that Bitcoin. and that you haven't given it to someone else.
Yeah.
Does that sort of make sense?
It does. I think it's still very early days in terms of the Bitcoin auditing. And I think each auditor will do it differently. The way I asked about it, it sounded like all they wanted to do was kind of see the address or like a screenshot. Like it was very unsophisticated. It wasn't really an audit in my opinion, but
no.
That's what they seemed to want.
I talked to my auditor and because they had said that we normally ask for a screenshot from within your wallet, which is like phone screenshot. And I mentioned that that's really doesn't really prove anything whatsoever, but I can provide that if that's what's required.
Yeah.
But my funds were in cold storage. I didn't have it in the wallet to screenshot for them. And that's when he asked for the public key. But I was curious and said, so do you know what to do with the public key once you have it? Do you know how to derive the receiving address? He said, no, that's not for me to really know.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to know that. I just need to have enough information that looks like, you know, we know where it is.
Yeah.
So you're right. It's not very sophisticated right now. There's a lot of different things sort of happening, but it normally is those two, public key or receiving address.
Yeah.
So as long as you keep that in mind. But be prepared for in future when they start saying things, we need you to sign a message with your private key, because that's very confusing for most people. But Sparrow Wallet, Samurai Wallet, make it really easy to do
that. Okay, yeah, because I think it's best to just ask, because what they want is probably not what you would think you should provide.
Exactly. The good thing about the audit is it's kind of like a conversation. So you give all the documentation to your accountant. Your accountant says, hey, look, we need this and this and this as well. The accountant gives it to the auditor. The auditor writes back and says, actually, we need a bit more detail here, or I'd like to see this statement too. I then provide that detail. I ended up having a phone call with the auditor after that, where they said everything is actually compliant. There's no issues here, but you shouldn't own Bitcoin because it's very volatile.
Yeah.
We had that conversation, interestingly enough. So I think that's the other thing for people to be mindful of, is that sometimes you might feel a bit intimidated by an auditor saying, I don't think Bitcoin should be in self-managed superannuation funds. But keep in mind, that is not a compliance issue. That's more of a personal opinion that they may have.
Yes.
So you can always clarify that by saying, are there any compliance issues with this? And when they say no, you know that you've got like the tick of approval that you're fine.
Yeah. I mean, they just want to trace the money. I want to see it leave your account, go into Hardblock, you bought the Bitcoin, it leaves Hardblock, goes to the address. Okay, that address matches on the blockchain, the Hardblock, or the address in the Hardblock account. Once they see all that, I think they're pretty happy.
I think so.
Because you're saying that that's true. And if you lie, there's penalties.
Exactly.
So that's kind of what they're, it all falls back on that.
It is.
Are you saying the truth?
It's an honor system similar to ATO. Similar to like, you know, normal personal tax.
Yes.
Like when you put in your tax return, they're only checking on that if you happen to be audited at some point in your life, which not everyone does, and only for a certain period you usually are. So otherwise, it's an honor system.
Yeah.
And the good thing is as well, if you buy and hold Bitcoin and just literally hold it for the foreseeable future, after your first audit, the rest of them become very, very easy, because you might be buying more Bitcoin, but you're probably putting that into new receiving addresses, perhaps. The old ones are there. They remain unchanged. It shouldn't be that big of an issue in terms of audit to verify those last ones.
Yeah.
Should we maybe move on to, I guess, our thinking in terms of what sort of investments made sense for self-managed superannuation funds?
Definitely. With the caveat, this is not investment advice.
Exactly. This is more our personal thinking about things and what we've done.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think it's worth in breaking down, because our modern finance system is so convoluted and not how it should be, like what saving and investing is.
Yep.
So for me, saving is when you put your, like you work and you earn some money and you save it in money, not currency like the Australian dollar.
Yes.
It's not money because it's not a store of value.
That's correct.
And the only forms of money that I guess value are Bitcoin, silver and gold bullion. And so that's a way of saving money for the future. And money is meant to buy you the same thing when you retire than it does now. So if 1 ounce of gold can buy you, I don't know, half a cow, then when I'm 65, it should still buy me half a cow and allow me to buy my food when I'm retired and not working. Investing is when you take some risk to actually make more money back. So I might put in 10 ounces of gold in a company, and if that company does well, I might get 20 ounces of gold back. But I might get zero as well.
Mm.
Like I'm taking a risk. So you always want your investments to outperform your money. Now, if your money's Bitcoin, it's very hard for your investments to outperform your money.
True.
But you want to think about that way. Okay, well, how much money should I have? How diversified should that be? I tend to like the way that Nassim Taleb thinks about it, which is you probably have 85% of your investments really safe, which is ideally self-custody money, so gold and silver and Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. It is a bit tricky to self-custody gold and silver bullion in super. I ended up just setting up an account with Perth Mint, and I've got mine there. And then you have to think about the investment. So within the whole investment class, there's asset categories. So you've got like debt, which is like bonds for either government or corporate bonds, which we can get into, but we don't recommend because you can just make lots of them. Then you've got.
They don't seem to be performing that well either.
Yeah, exactly. Then you've got equity. So, like taking a stake in a, like being a part owner of a company.
Yep.
So, taking a share in a company, real estate, or potentially like collectibles. Like some people might fine wine or something.
Or art or something.
Yeah, exactly. Which I don't know anything about, so I haven't got anything like that. But those are kind of your categories of if you want to invest and make more money than you already have, that's where you could start to think about.
Just as a funny aside, if you do invest in fine wine or art, you're not allowed to look at it and enjoy it.
Oh, no.
And you definitely cannot drink it because that would be for personal use.
So yes.
It really has to be for investment purposes only. If you buy collectibles or art, you can't display it at your house. It needs to be pretty much in like a vault or an equivalent type of vault somewhere where it's just for investment purposes. So that's useful to keep in mind because I know some people have thought, oh, this is great. I can buy all the stuff I want to decorate my house with and it's actually an investment too. It's like, that would break the sole purpose rule, which is purely for investment, not for personal enjoyment.
Exactly right. One of the simplest things that you could do is, so I've got a list here. There's a website, a Wikipedia page that has all of the ETFs that are listed on the ASX, Stock Exchange. So an ETF is like you're like buying a share, but underneath that is investments and other things.
Mm-hmm.
So they might have just put all of the money into gold bullion or into Australian shares or international shares. If you just want to recreate the super that you already had, like, you know, 20% Australian shares, 20% international shares, you can just buy the ETFs that, you know, in proportion if that's what you want. But instead of, say, buying the bonds, you could buy gold or Bitcoin or, you know. So there's a list on, we'll put a link in the notes, just showing all the ETFs you can buy. There's some silly ones like game, which is like a video game ETF.
Yeah.
But there's gold bullion, there's bonds, there's real estate. So if that's the simplest way you could just do it, you know, in terms of rather than researching companies, you can just buy these ETFs. Some of them have very low fees, like the S&P 500, the US shares one, the fee is less than 0.1% a year.
That's good. Cause sometimes that can be as high as, you know, 1 or 2%.
It can be several percent. Mm. Yeah. So that's kind of an easy way to do it.
Yeah.
But then, well, I really think if you invest in yourself, and it does take time about learning how to which companies to buy and which sectors to buy, that can pay off hugely. But it does take a lot of time and investment in yourself, in your research.
You need to be kind of an expert in what makes a good company or a good business.
Yeah.
Like what, and you need to look into the company specifically. So like, what's their roadmap? Who is on their board that's sort of driving towards that roadmap? What kind of liabilities do they have? What sort of cash flow do they have? What sort of assets do they have? What kind of actual just cash do they have that's available as well? So all of those things, like when I look at the stock market, there's not a lot of companies that I would buy if they were a small business that I wanted to run. So I wouldn't want to buy them as a very, very large business with a lot of liabilities. Yeah, so it's worthwhile to consider the time investment that goes into researching those companies, but also just having that skill to be able to do that in the first place as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you don't want to do that, I don't see anything really wrong with just having money.
Mm.
Like, it's pretty safe. And at the moment, there's such a massive reward on investment because most people are holding currency.
Yeah.
And when they realize their currency is devaluing fast, they're going to rush into money.
Exactly.
And so I think if you're there first, you get the benefit of the fact that it preserves your purchasing power, but also you're going to get a gain in purchasing power because everyone's going to rush into it.
That's right. Is it Gresham's law where it's hard money chases away good money or something?
Yeah, everyone goes into the hardest money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
over time.
Everything you've said makes complete sense, and I agree with all of it as well. The way I approached it was I had like sort of four principles in mind. So I thought, I want to buy something that's not currently overvalued. So again, kind of looking at it like if I'm going to buy a business, you want something that's got good cash flow, et cetera. So that immediately ruled out most equities and even things like real estate to me. I wanted something with good long-term fundamentals. So it looked like it was maybe at the beginning of an uptrend rather than towards the end or somewhere in the middle. And that to me meant things like commodities as we head into like an inflationary period or a higher inflationary period because we've always been in an inflationary period. Precious metals as well, so like gold, silver, and of course, Bitcoin being the obvious one that's very much sort of just getting started but has a great long-term fundamental outlook. The other two things were something with ample liquidity and that I can sell portions of it. So if, say, in that first step, I thought houses aren't oversold, so I'll buy a house or some sort of property.
Yep.
The problem is if you want to actually rotate out of that, it can take several months or even up to a year to be able to sell. And of course, you can't sell like a small amount of it.
No.
Well, you can technically, but it's highly difficult to do that. So something that I can actually rotate in and out of if I need to, or sell small portions of if I need to. And the last one was probably the most important one for me, which is low or no counterparty risk. And to me, that means not stocks, not bonds, and to some degree, not property either. And so everything kind of keeps triangulating back to commodities, precious metals, and especially Bitcoin, you know, going by those sort of four principles that I was initially looking at.
Yeah. I mean, I ruled out property as well because, I mean, you can leverage it up even in your super. So there's that advantage. But then you're, like I said, you can't just buy 0.1 of a house.
Yeah.
You buy the whole thing. And then what if something in that city, like say you had an apartment in New York prior to COVID, then everyone left the city, then the demand for your apartment is down.
Yeah.
So there's a huge risk, then you can't just, you know, move it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So for me, property is that. But, you know, if you're an expert in property, then it might be something you choose to do. I see it as if I'm taking counterparty risk and I'm buying into a company, the return has to be much, much greater than 100%.
Yes.
Because I might lose half or all of my money,
mm.
but I'm prepared to do that if the return could be 10 times or That's 20 right. times, particularly if my money is Bitcoin. And so I've looked at, I kind of follow the contrarian style of investing, which is essentially money kind of flows around all the different financial categories and you want to be where the money isn't. The best example I've heard is it's like people on a boat. Lots of people are on one side of the boat and you're on the other side of the boat and yep. the people will rush to your side and you sell to them
mm.
and then you go somewhere else where the money isn't anymore. So at the moment, the money has been in American tech stocks and it hasn't been in commodities for a long time.
Mm.
It's starting to flow into commodities. So that's where you want to be because that's the sector of the, financial markets that has the least froth in it, you yeah. could say. I personally go for very small companies that are in the commodity sector. Mostly, and for me, silver mining, natural gas companies, and some uranium companies,
mm.
Because again, these are companies that haven't had much love, and you want to get in. But they are needed things. Like
fundamentally, it makes sense, doesn't it?
You need natural gas to make fertilizer, which you need to eat. So yeah. I'm pretty confident we're going to need to have that for the rest of our lives.
And uranium as like a producer of energy or a contributor to energy in terms of the commodity itself is orders of magnitude greater than intermittent renewable energies or even things like more reliable fossil fuels as well. So that kind of makes sense as a decision.
Yeah, well, like at the moment, just a tangent on uranium, the price of uranium is lower than the big companies are able to make a profit on mining it.
Gotcha.
So yeah. they basically, a lot of them have shut down their mines and they're just sort of waiting for the price to come up. But China's building 150 nuclear plants. 150.
Wow.
You know, so the demand is going to be there over this decade. So that's, there's all these different commodity sectors you can go and research. So yeah, I've got, I guess, a portfolio of small companies. A couple of things I think are worth sharing and really understanding if you do want to go down this path is understanding like the market cap of a company and its actual asset value. Not many people realize when you're buying shares, you're buying a portion of a company. And so it's really important to understand what that company is worth. I'll just give you some examples that I wrote down. So like if you want to go buy Ford now, the market cap is $52 billion.
Mm.
So that's kind of like saying, if I'm buying a share, I'm buying a portion of that $52 billion company.
Yeah.
You know, like why am I buying it? Is it because they're going to make profits that will, exceed that amount over my lifetime or something?
Yeah.
Toyota is $219 billion. And what would you guess Tesla is?
It's going to be something ludicrous, isn't it? Because I feel like it should be less than those two because they certainly don't have that much of the market share. I don't know. I'm just going to say like double what Toyota's is.
It's four times.
Oh, Jesus.
It's $135 billion.
That's, again, peak fiat absurdity.
Exactly. But what's great about investing in shares is they have to publish their accounts.
Yes.
So you can go it's usually every half year, but sometimes every quarter and say, okay, what is this company worth in terms of their assets?
Mm.
And just a couple of examples. So like Tesla's market cap is $835 billion, but the value of the company, like the equity value, is $36
billion. Wow.
So the gap between those two is basically speculation
mm.
that they're going to grow into a very big company and, yep. and make lots of profits. I personally don't think that's the case. I'm not a Tesla investor, but that's just an example. I've got a couple of Australian mining companies just to give you a comparison.
Yeah.
So one's called Silver Lake Resources. I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying this is one that you could look at just in terms of learning about how it works. They're a gold miner. They have a market cap of $1.26 billion Australian dollars and their equity value is $942 million. So you're not paying that much above what the actual asset value of the company is. Undervalued,
you'd probably say. Yeah.
And even within that, they've got $267 million of cash.
Mm.
You know, so that's 1 to 1.2 times the value. Another one is a silver miner. The code is SVL Silver Mines. The market cap's $200 million. The equity value is $120. So again, not crazy. So you want to be buying at those compressed values. When the money comes in, you can sell into that in a few years or 10 years or whatever. The other thing I think is worth considering is paying for research.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually pay for research from your SMSF. So like a monthly newsletter or something like that, which good I do.
Yep.
I think rather than trying to do everything yourself, because I think what I tend to find is free content, like on YouTube or podcast, is paid for by someone else.
Yes.
Now that someone else, especially in finance, often has the opposite agenda of informing you. Yep. Sometimes, in fact, they're trying to sell, they're giving the false information so the institutions can kind of dump their stock onto you.
That's all the vice versa, trying to suppress the price so they can keep buying in gradually, that, not exactly. Move the market too much, but you've decided, I'm not going to touch this company because all these reports said that it's going to be bad, and then it pumps a year later or something.
Exactly right. And that's that Wyckoff distribution, which if you ever see that video, you should watch it. That's been going on for 100 years, where like the newspaper will publish articles which are saying the opposite of the truth because people are trying to, you know, either dump stock onto you or buy your stock cheaply. So I really think it's worth, if you do want to do your own investing, find some really good publications, whether they're Australian or international, like Substack has heaps, and pay for quality content out of your SMSF. Like, that's an investment in itself.
Yeah. Do you have ones that you would, I don't know, like not recommend officially, but at least say, hey, I like these ones. Maybe you should have a look too.
Yeah. Well, the ones that I pay for are Doomberg, which is, they're kind of like scientists, and they like analyze events. And there was a really good one they put out last week, where they looked at a tractor that was ammonia powered, and they're like, that can't be right. And it was supposedly to improve carbon emissions, but the carbon emissions would double just a diesel tractor, you know. So like, they'll present science, and you can do your own interpretation. Like, they might say, you know, one time they said phosphate fertilizer was being banned in China. Exports were being banned. So you think, okay, well, that means that these stocks are going to go down. Is there like a phosphate fertilizer company or miner in Australia on the ASX? You can, you know, do your own research.
Yeah.
So I think that's $50 a month or something, or maybe it's $30 a month, something like that. And I also pay for a guy called Grant Williams, who's excellent. You can either get his podcast separately, or you can get the podcast and the newsletter and combine them. So it's not cheap, but you get what you pay for.
That's good. And especially the way that we probably conceptually see superannuation, where it's just like this separate thing that's not part of our money.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It makes it easier to pay something like that, like $500 or $1,000 a year on basically someone doing that research for you, with probably better predictive outcomes than what you could be able to do in just like a few months or even a few years worth of initially researching things like stocks or investment opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to be careful, because some of them, you know, like we've seen in the crypto space, you pay for them and then they're just shilling stuff to you anyway.
True.
But yeah, you've got to find good quality content. And yeah, I think it's worth paying for, because if you're not paying for it, someone else is paying them. And yeah, they don't have the same agenda as you.
I think the general conceptual thing that you mentioned before, like the Nassim Taleb idea of like 85% in, it's probably not his words, but like hard money, something that you know is like risk off or risk averse and has good fundamentals, good recognizability, like consistency. And that would be things like Bitcoin, precious metals quite likely, and even things like commodities that are used to build things, and we're going to keep needing to build things. And then 15% in the where you dabbled in risk. And
that's right.
Things like stocks or equities or something like that.
And the great thing is, knowing now that I've got Bitcoin, like I know that 20 years of when I can access this thing, or 25 years, that's going to be worth a lot.
Yeah.
So I don't have, like, I can actually afford to take some risk.
Yeah.
And I can afford to spend some of my other money on research, newsletters and so on.
That's it.
Whereas I think if you've got a standard kind of portfolio, you're taking a lot of risk on the whole thing.
Mm.
And you sort of have to be conservative in some ways, and not take too much risk, because everything is unsafe.
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
If you've got 40% in bonds, like, there's nothing safe in your entire portfolio.
True.
So I feel so much more comfortable taking a lot of risk in a small amount. So risk management is important. So don't, you know, put 100% of your equities in, of your super in, you know, one stock. But having appropriate risk management, like having 10 or 20 stocks in small amounts. But yeah, you feel like you can take the risk, because you've got the backing of, well, if I screw up my entire portfolio, which is 15%, I've still got my gold and silver and my Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's always good to, yeah, to come back to that, in terms of, we've gotten into this cultural thing about being good at investment.
Yep.
We don't really need to be good at investment. We either need to hire the services of someone who is good at investment, or we need to be good enough and take some risks. But I think saving in money means that you don't have to be good at investment.
No, you
and
don't.
I think, yeah, kind of like that conceptual shift, because for a long time, that's what I felt I needed to do when I was getting into Bitcoin and like the broader crypto space.
Yep.
And even then started thinking like, maybe I should be looking at like stocks and property and stuff as well. Is you think you need to invest, but that investment is risky. So I think kind of like knocking that on its head and saying, well, you don't have to do that with a lot of your money. You just need to maybe do that with a small amount of your money. And in some cases, you might not need to do that at all. You need
yeah,
to
I mean, I don't think you
consistent.
Do. I actually quite enjoy doing it. So it's probably why I do it. But I mean, realistically, a portfolio of gold, silver, and Bitcoin is probably fine. I mean, I don't think the gold and silver will go up forever. I think they've probably got 10 years in them.
Yeah.
I think eventually Bitcoin will overtake them. But if that's what you've got now, I think you'd be pretty secure.
I think the one of the riskier parts that often goes unsaid about investments is that you can do all the due diligence in the world and you mentioned this in a recent podcast that we did as well, that kind of technical analysis one, is that you can't predict black swan events.
No.
So you could say this company is undervalued, they have good cash flow, they don't have too many liabilities, they look like they've got a good board, a good roadmap, good fundamentals, you know, they've got assets. And then, of course, a government says, oh, actually, we're moving away from that type of energy.
Yeah.
Or there is, you know, a discovery of a greater supply of something, like, you know, gold recently. There's those sort of things that you can't predict.
No.
And then you also can't predict, like, when will that reverberate through the markets? Because sometimes you get that black swan type news and nothing actually happens. It doesn't seem to like budge the price whatsoever. And sometimes you get something that seems much less significant, but it does move the price. And the thing is, you could have done all the best due diligence and research in the world, but there's just that black swan event and then the effect psychologically that it has on the markets, that's just so difficult to predict.
Definitely. And I think that's where two things, risk management is important to not, you know, if you've got 15% in say equities, and you have 10 different companies or 20, then you're each bet you make, because you have to think, I think of those bets.
They are, essentially.
Is only like 1 or maybe 2% of your entire portfolio. Mm. So if you screw it up, like something politically happens. You know, I had this rare earths miner in Greenland, a massive, massive resource of rare earths. And then the government changed and they were anti-mining. And so immediately the value of that went down like 40%.
Yeah.
But that's okay if you're going for really big returns.
Mm.
So like if you're buying something where you think it could go up 5 or 10 times and it goes down 50%, okay, that one failed, but another one will make up for it.
Yes, yeah.
But you can't do that when you're buying like bonds. You can't take risk when you're buying something that's going to return you 3 or 4%. Like you can't take any risk at all because the return is so low.
Exactly.
So yeah, there's. I think it's safe to assume that almost anything you buy has some sort of external influence, whether maybe the government changes the taxes.
Yeah.
Which Queensland has just done on coal miners, I think, or yeah, some new technology comes in and all of a sudden your thing is not valuable. Or
that's right.
There's so many risks you can take. But if the returns are high enough, then it's okay to take those risks.
True. Sometimes looking at bonds, it seems less and less fathomable of being a good investment, given that you're right, like you might make a few percent in terms of the return. Most people don't see bonds as a risky asset, but there is an increasing chance of a debt default with bonds. And it's happened in countries in the past. It's happening in countries now. Most people look at places like, say, the US or Australia and think, well, that'll never happen. But that's what we've thought about many other countries and their bonds in the past as well. So really, like the way that I look at bonds is that, okay, I might get between, you know, 0.5 and 3% return, depending on, you know, which bond and when I buy. But at the same time, I could lose 100% of that value. That doesn't actually seem that great of a deal to
me.
Whereas in the past, I've had people say, well, if you buy Bitcoin, you don't actually get a return. Yes, but I'm at least getting the 100% upside if it does go up. And sure, I take the 100% downside risk if it goes to zero, which seems sort of unfathomable for it to go there now. But at least you get the full return when it goes up. Whereas if bonds do, you don't actually get to kind of actualize that return. You're mainly just getting the interest rate on the bond.
Yeah. I mean, over time, when we have like a hard money society, hopefully in our lifetime, you get the economic return. So as technology improves and things become cheaper, that's where your return comes from, because your money is holding its value. And so you in your money, in your Bitcoin or your gold, you need less of it to buy the same thing.
Yeah.
Like how in our lifetimes, computers have become heaps cheaper because technology's improved that.
That's it.
But that should happen with everything, because economic progress should make things cheaper.
Yes. Yeah.
I've heard Safedean talk about how in the future, he doesn't think there will be debt anymore. It'll just be equity. Because why would you like not want the upside and take all of the, you know, take a fixed kind of return and take all this risk? It'll just be Bitcoin and equities. There'll be no debt in the middle. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't make any sense now, but a lot of people have it.
And I think it's just because that's what we've been doing. And
yeah.
That's sort of the natural trajectory that we're on, is to keep doing more of that, because otherwise the whole thing kind of collapses and you have to start again.
Yeah.
Which it makes sense to rip the Band-Aid off. Otherwise everyone just gets poor very slowly,
like
barreling ahead.
And it comes back to that benchmarking. If people are benchmarked on the, you know, having some debt and having some Australian shares and they beat the index by 0.1%, then
that's
they get a bonus.
Yeah, exactly right. Jack Mallers was talking recently, I think it was at like a shitcoin conference, and they tried to sort of like weasel shitcoins in there, and he more or less said it's got, you know, not the same as Bitcoin whatsoever. And the way that he described Bitcoin, perhaps I'll link it because I'm not going to do it justice, of course, if you've ever heard Jack Mallers' rants. But he more or less said like Bitcoin is really the only asset that has no third party risk, essentially, no liabilities. It's very rare. Well, it is the only asset of that kind, because even if you look at things like precious metals, there is a supply change that can happen if the price, you know, is enough. If you look at like stocks or properties, there is some level of third-party risk in terms of like with stocks. They could issue more stocks, for example. You're buying into the developers that work in that company or the executives or their roadmap or their ability to stick to the roadmap, like all those sort of things, as well as like geopolitical risk and currency wars and that sort of thing going on. Like there is a lot of even indirect third-party risk by buying a lot of these other assets. His point being that with Bitcoin, you're not. You know, if you wanted to say, I don't even want to support the developers of Bitcoin anymore, I'm going to lock down my node at this particular software and never upgrade again so I can always have this Bitcoin, you can do that. Like there's a chance for you to then sort of close the doors to that third party risk. So just an interesting way to look at it. And especially given the world is becoming so much more, obvious that there is so much third party risk in kind of everything that we do. That seems like a nice like refuge to some degree to say, at least I have this one asset where I'm not relying on someone else for it.
Really. Exactly. And we were actually talking in the office today about doing the self-custody. Because if you wanted to self-custody gold bullion in your super or silver bullion, you can actually do that. But you have to insure it.
Mm.
So it's actually becoming like a negative yield.
Yeah.
And if someone finds that coin, they take it.
Yeah.
Whereas if someone finds your seed phrase, and you have a passphrase somewhere else,
they still can't take
it. They can't take it. Yeah. It's just such an amazing thing to be able to self-custody in such a secure way.
That's it. And even coming back to things like scarcity, which is different to a third-party risk, of course. But, you know, Bitcoin, if it becomes, or when it becomes far greater adopted than it is now and far higher valued than it is now, you can't just make more of it and say, great, well, let's get more people into mining. We'll make even more of this stuff and profit off it. It's just like the supply issuance keeps decreasing over time. It's set. The difficulty adjustment means it's going to always stay to that. Whereas other assets, as they become higher in value, people will mine more of them.
Absolutely.
Or they'll try to seek out more of it.
Yeah. I mean, silver is one where like it's got a good short-term potential, but you want to get out of it when it's frothy, because when they start mining it, the stock to flow is not actually very good compared to Bitcoin or even gold.
I guess, a way that I often look at this, I mentioned those four principles that sort of coordinated my thinking initially, but I do like coming back to, as we're Bitcoiners, kind of Bitcoin or hard money focused principles. So like Saifedean's idea of scalability across time, space, and scale. Sorry, I said scalability. I meant saleability, like the ability to sell it in future, the ability to sell it across space to different locations, and the ability to sell it at, you know, minute amounts or very large amounts. Like that makes sense to me if I'm choosing a money to have like 85% of my value in, and then I can dabble with the other 15% in other stuff. The money that I choose needs to be saleable across time, space, and scales as well. The more kind of detailed way of saying that would be things like what you might have seen in like Vijay Boyapati's The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, talked a lot by people like, you know, Robert Breedlove in terms of those qualities of money. And that's things like, you know, scarcity, durability, immutability, or censorship resistance, which is not something we talk much about, but probably really important going forward with your money. As well as, again, portability, someone recognizing it or accepting it as money as well is very important, and being able to divide it and it being completely fungible with other types portions of that asset. So those are the things to me when I'm choosing my 85% hard money to save money. When I come back to,
And I guess if you think about it from an SMSF perspective, so you've got your investment strategy, which all of the parties have to agree to.
Mm.
In my case, it's my wife and I, but it could be up to six people.
Yep.
So you all have to agree and how it's written out. So you might be happy with 85% Bitcoin, but some people might think, and I kind of agree with them, that, well, there is a risk that, what if I've got 85%, if it does fail, what's my backup?
Yeah.
And that's why I think a mixture of Bitcoin and silver and gold, you know, if you had a mixture of those as your 85% money, you couldn't really go wrong, I don't think.
Especially with the potential upside of each of them being orders of magnitude more than the current price. Only one of them needs to be successful
for
you to be quite comfortable with any other risks that you might have taken.
Exactly right. Whereas if you go 100% Bitcoin, which no one will stop you doing that, you can do that if you both agree, if everyone agrees in your investment strategy. But if there is a chance Bitcoin could fail, I don't know what it is, quantum computers or something. Like, we shouldn't assume it will be 100% guaranteed to succeed.
Yeah.
Then what's your retirement plan?
That's true. Yeah. It's, we get very caught up in it, don't we? And I mean, I still have the belief that it's a when, not an if scenario with Bitcoin.
I do too. Yep.
But we don't know black swan type events.
Yep.
We don't know, like, no one would have thought Bitcoin was going to be a thing before it was invented anyway, I guess, except for the few that were dabbling in things like decentralized kind of ledgers and decentralized money. They might have had an inkling that something like this could work eventually, but the majority of people didn't. And I don't think, we don't have the finger on the pulse as much as that we probably think that we do in like everything that's going on in the world and everything that could potentially happen in future. So it is always good to, just for lack of better terms, I guess, hedge your bets.
Yeah. you know, I mean, Bitcoin does need the, you know, the internet and electricity, which I really hope are around for a long time. But,
yeah.
You know, gold and silver coins don't. So that's how, you know, like the really hardcore gold bugs, they're like, well, this works in every scenario.
That's it. Although I've heard some good points made that we don't even need the internet for Bitcoin. We just need mesh networks.
Yes.
We need, you know, ham radio or satellites and that kind of thing. So, but yeah, look, I think keep in mind the general principles that we've talked about in terms of how you might look at things like, you know, companies or properties or even other sort of forms of hard money as well. And risk management, I guess, being the key to it.
Yeah. I think the final thing I'd probably say about the SMSF is, especially if you're kind of a bit younger, you don't need to rush. Like, you don't need to make 20% guaranteed interest. You know, like if you're making a positive return every year and you compound that over 20, 30 years, you'll be fine.
Mm.
You just don't want to make the negative returns.
Yes.
So that you've got time on your side when you're, when you start thinking about that way, it's kind of reassuring because you just have to make sure that you're going in the right direction and time will sort out the rest.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, you want to have a directionally correct play.
Yep.
And then don't worry about trying to time it because you have a long time.
Exactly right.
Probably, I feel like most Bitcoiners just would go without saying, but it's still good to mention it because of all the stuff that's going on in the world right now in terms of rehypothecation and fractional reserve banking and yield and lending platforms and the way that a lot of them are kind of collapsing at the moment from actual legitimate government, somewhat sanctioned banks to even cryptocurrency and Bitcoin platforms, is that if you do decide, you know, 85% or something in hard money sounds good and you self-custody it, which is, I think, an important part too, is that don't put it back in for gains. Don't put it back in for 20% or 15% or 5% or what, doesn't matter, even if they guarantee you 500%. I think the point is you don't want to buy an asset that has no third party risk and then go give it to a custodian and absorb all of that third party risk. It just doesn't make sense. So like realize the reason that you're buying certain assets and stick true to that reason as well. Don't start making it into like a stock or a bond by giving it to someone else and hoping it'll perform in a similar way to a stock or a bond or something like that.
Yeah, hard money in your control.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. Well, that's most of what I thought we would talk about today. It's just a setup process, maintaining any issues, as well as what we've chosen to invest on. Any other kind of points that were on your mind that you thought we'd talk about that we haven't?
No, I think it's, to me, it's kind of like the privacy thing as well. Like it's not as convenient, but it's so much better. So it's worth the effort.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Proof of work, really, isn't
it?
It's one of those things, you make the short-term sacrifice, you fill out a bunch of paperwork, you have to wait a little while, but then you get complete control over your funds and you're protected in all sorts of circumstances that you might not be able to anticipate could happen in future. And it makes it more real. Like my super has only become what feels like my money and where I'm going to kind of look at the risk properly since I had it in my self-managed super fund. Before that point, it was just this sort of bundle of money that didn't even feel like money or assets or anything. It was just sort of there in the background. It's only when I decided I might want to do something with this that suddenly it was like, where is this stuff?
Yeah.
How do I get access to it now? I need it now.
I 100% agree. I consider it much more mine than before.
Yeah. And I think it's a good motivator and a good way to give you skin in the game to actually associate or assess risks properly.
Definitely.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. Thanks, Jeremy, for your time.
No worries.
If you've found this helpful, please share it around. Subscribe if you haven't. If you can leave reviews on podcasting apps that you listen to, then please do, because that helps out the podcast. Otherwise, again, thank you for your time and until next time.